History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories right there around you that really need to be told, that we're all better off for the privilege of hearing. The goal is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn so much. We're educated, we're entertained, and often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. With the 75th anniversary of the Normandy invasion approaching, we've been counting down to D-Day, and we'll continue that today with two men who experienced that longest day in very different fashions. Since this is Memorial Day weekend, we'll also take a turn in that direction before we're done, hearing from a man whose new book honors his uncle who never made it home from World War II. You can find links to all the material mentioned today at hometownheroesradio.com. And we'll begin that Normandy focus with the memories of Oklahoma native E.T. Roberts, who landed on Omaha Beach on D-Day with the 115th Regiment of the 29th Infantry Division.
We were to hit Omaha 8/20 D-Day with assisted assault, we were told. And they said there'd be bomb craters on the beach when we trained. And I trained with rifle and flamethrower, too. I had a flamethrower when I hit the beach. And I went off the ramp, and I never did touch bottom. And I turned the flamethrower loose. And I had a soldier behind me that had my full field pack. I had a lot of good stuff in my pack, in my bedding, in my eats and everything in that pack. And he had my rifle. He's supposed to go off the same time as me behind me. And as soon as I got rid of that flamethrower, give me my rifle and stuff to let me go. But I've never seen that boy yet today. I don't know whatever happened to all that crew. But I had to turn that flamethrower loose. It's going to drown me. And the tide was so high, it come up under my helmet like it broke my neck. And I had to lay there on the beach until I got my neck straightened up and I crawled over and got a rifle from a soldier that was wounded there, or dead. I'm sure he's dead because I see his entrails and stuff laying out on the ground that were shrapnel. What I disintegrated him almost. Anyway, I got up on the beach and went up on the hill, and all I ever saw of my whole company was seven of us left. I don't know whatever happened to the rest. I've never seen them yet today. And then when we went into combat, I got wounded about 29 days after I got into combat at St. Lo. And I went out, and when I came back into combat, they didn't send me back to my company. They sent me back to 116th.
As you're heading toward Omaha Beach, and you're on that landing craft, I imagine the big picture of everything you could see in every direction was something that you've never seen again since. What did it look like as you were approaching that beach?
When I was sitting out there, we were hit June 5th. We were supposed to hit the 5th, and the tide was so high that we couldn't go in. We had to sit out there, and you could step from ship to ship that was taking soldiers in there, and you couldn't see nothing across that ocean as far as you could see, with ships and stuff going in to make the invasion in there. And we went in the next June 6th, the next day. All of us was seasick, but when you say ramp down, you got to get off. You can't turn back. You got to go. So we had all had to go. And when you hear people today say, "I'm sick, I can't go to work," think about something like that and see how that fix. When they dump you off over there, seasick, and the boat was full of vomit and stuff that way. It really was. It was a mess. So that's what we went through with. And then it was 9 days before we ever got any good clothes to put on. We hit that salt water and stuff. You can imagine what our feet and stuff was.
And I want to ask you, as you hit that water, you described for us having that flamethrower on, and this is a big heavy thing that you're going to wear on your back, 72 pounds of equipment there.
and you come off that ramp, you're expecting your feet are going to hit bottom, but you just kept sinking?
Well, they told us, they said, unbuckle your chin straps because the tide will come up under your helmet. And I didn't unbuckle my chin strap. The flamethrower I thought would help me too, but the flamethrower is what took me down so fast that tide came up under and hurt my neck, like broke my neck, I guess. And since I came home in civilian life, I'd had two discs replaced in my neck and everything.
It's not exaggerating to say that you nearly died just coming off the landing craft.
Oh, sure. I'm lucky to be here today. People could never, I can't even understand myself how I ever lived through the smoke and gunfire. He said you couldn't hear nothing. It was the smoke, it was strangling you. It was so thick, gun smoke. Just shell after shell and big facing a cannon sitting inside of a wall that was far and out there and nothing. I saw little LCVPs come in there, not one soldier get off of it. That shell, the way they had it, big, the gun emplacement, they said had 4 foot of cement in it and sitting in the walls, just like going into a side of a house and look out the windows. The gun placements looked like that to me. I could see them far and all out of there. I told the guy on the Marine or sailor, whatever he was on the ship, I said, open fire on him. Open fire on that guy there. And he was the security, run off the top. I don't know where he ever went to. That's when we was going in. I could see that firing was taking place there. But when I got out on the beach and I got straightened up and got up off of the beach, I met about seven people from the same company I didn't know, even hardly. Got me a rifle and stuff and went on through there, and then I got wounded with St. Lowe. I got changed from first scout to a squad leader, and we were completely replaced 9 times. So when they start to ask me, tell me names and stuff, I finally got to where I'm just going to call you soldier. And that's about the way I think today. People tell me names, and I can't think of names. I think of stuff like that so many names came and said, well, this is so-and-so, this so-and-so, and maybe 30 minutes he'd be not there. I've seen him last about 30 minutes in combat, and that's about it.
Certainly there on June 6th, and it's been called the longest day for a really good reason, especially the part of it you were in.
I couldn't get off of there. I was sick and had to lay there, and I got my neck straightened up, and that water was solid blood. I mean, it was just like a bloodbath going through it there. The beach, you couldn't walk without stepping on a dead soldier. You crawled and made your way around through there to get off of the beach, and finally I did. Got off the beach. I don't know. Some people say, how long did it take you to get off the beach? I don't know. I don't think anybody else would. There's so much going on and everything that you don't, you couldn't even tell anybody your name, probably.
So it's definitely loud. I'm sure the smell was horrific. Obviously, what you're seeing is something that no one has ever seen or experienced before. And I'm just trying to imagine myself in your shoes. How did you keep going? Weren't you scared to death?
You're past scared. You don't even know who you're at or what you're doing. Think about fighting day and night. 27 days without ever coming off of the front line, and the only way it got you off is to get shot. And then I was out 26 days back into combat. Went back to England and patched me up and sent me back into combat.
Another thing you mentioned about D-Day, you talked about finding seven other guys from your company. For people who aren't familiar with how that works, how many people were in your company to begin with? How many from your company were supposed to hit that beach?
200 and something soldiers there in the company. I never did see any of the boys, the lieutenant or nobody. I never seen no one after that. So I don't know where the bunch of them went. One good friend that I did meet him, and he went in with me there. And last time I saw him, he had his heel shot off. We hit the ground, machine gun fire came up. He didn't put down his feet flat like you're supposed to turn your feet out flat. He stuck his heels up, he put his toes to the ground, and he shot his heels off. And I went over and talked to him a little bit, and I said, well, I got to go. We was moving at that time, and I had to go on, and we was trying to run them people out of there. And that's, I don't know whatever happened to that boy. It's just one of them things that happens in combat. I had another friend came in there that I knew, got acquainted with from Oklahoma boy, Donald Crawford. There was an artillery shell was coming over. And I told him, I said, get your whole artillery. You can hear artillery coming over. And I said, go get your hole. And I don't know why he did, but he put a piece of tin over his hole. When he started to go down the hole, piece of tin caught him on right above his forehead, just scalped him almost. I don't know whatever happened to that boy either. Things like that happens in combat.
Yeah, and we know what happened to you, and we're going to find out the rest of what happened to you. I wonder, you talk about climbing into your hole, and as that longest day came to a close, and you tried to find out if you could actually sleep that night and think about what the future might hold, were you able to sleep? How could you possibly sleep after a day like that?
We don't know when we slept. I mean, I've asked some guys, they know when they slept, but not a combat boy that was in there and hit that beastie day. If they'd tell me when they slept, I would sure like to talk to them and understand how they went to sleep, because I never remember sleeping. I think I sleep with my eyes open. I believe that's the only way we did sleep. And another thing, when you get replacements in that way, and you talk about sleeping, you don't know. The guys you train with, you could trust. I mean, he'd say, well, you go ahead and go to sleep, and I'll pull guard duty while you sleep. But at nighttime, when you set up to get some rest, and you say, okay, you sleep a while, and I'll sleep a while. You go to sleep, you wake up, and he's asleep too. He might have been a butcher or a candlestick maker or whatever. You don't know what they are when they come into combat replacements. They're not trained like we were trained to fight. And it's very scary to be in combat with people like that.
And obviously you had a close call just getting off the Higgins boat, hitting the beach. But for the rest of that day on Omaha Beach, the bloodiest day of that invasion, the bloodiest spot of that invasion, how close did gunfire, artillery, or any of that come to you personally?
I could hear it whistle above my ears. I've heard shells sing beautiful song right beside my ears, bullets and stuff. And just look, when I got wounded, there was one went off my helmet, one hit me in the shoulder, and three went through my field jacket. So, and the flame hit me right in the face. I faced the face with one. And what happened, the kid that was one of the replacements was there. He was hollering at me, said, the soldier said, get this guy off my back. They'd done come over the hedgerow and got on his back, and I turned to get his back, and this one came over the hedgerow with a burp gun. It came right down to me, and all I ever saw was flame and fire. And I didn't know I was shot for a while, and I kept trying to get my gun up. My arm was, shoulders cramping and everything, and blood was running all over me. And I was trying to get my gun up to shoot another one was coming over there. And then I knew that I was finished. So when I started out, I laid down my rifle and walked off. And I got back to the hedgerow behind me, and right at I started to go out the gate, there's a German pulled down on me again. I thought, well, this is it here. And he saw I was bloody and sick and everything, and he let me go. So I went back, and that's when I had to go to England and patch me up.
So here you are. You've been on the front lines basically for a month, and you're in St. Lo, and you talk about this burp gun, and people who maybe haven't seen one before. I mean, this is an automatic rifle, Schmeisser, that the Germans had that could fire rounds so fast.
They call them great little grease guns. There's like our little Thompson subs, they call them.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what they are, although they're a little smaller. And they will spit some rounds out at you, yes.
So fast that they could literally saw you in half.
Oh, yes, yes. He thought he had it to center me, but he had it to side of me, luckily. And I was trying to punch another guy off of one's back there, and I'm sure that I got him off of there, but I don't know about this. The guy was shooting me at what I done to him.
How far away was he from you?
he was in slapping distance.
So from point blank range, he's firing this gun that can pump out multiple rounds a second, and five of them hit you?
The fire was just blinded me. I mean, it was so close to me that he's right in my face, and I didn't have. In fact, he's further than my gun would reach, even closer to me. He just cut me right down me. If I could got to him with the gun, I could have punched him with my gun or something. But
it sounds like you were in a bit of shock.
Well, I guess I was, because there was so much going on. I was trying to help somebody, and then it all jumps on to me. When they start coming over the hedge or on top of you, too, well, then you got to start doing something for yourself, and you're kind of off guard a little bit. That's the reason, I guess, the only reason I got out of that I always wanted to help other people or do things.
Well, it kind of sounds like someone somewhere must have been helping you, too.
I think God had a great hand in it, helping me, because I never was afraid. I always thought that I would be taken care of, and that's what I feel today, that God has a big hand. And he's not finished with what he wants me to do, and that's something I want to do. It's whatever he asked me to do today, I want to do it.
Amen. It sounds, I mean, I didn't live it, you did, and I'm trying to imagine it, but it sure sounds pretty miraculous that you survived that, a burp gun from that close range.
Well, if it had been in the center of me, I wouldn't have, but the way it was, in my shoulder, in my arm, and off my helmet and everything, through my field jacket, it didn't get no part of me, and in no other part but just that part. Which that's the reason I had to go out and then come back in combat. They have to go through that to swab it out and clean it, because when you get shot through your shoulders or wherever you get shot, it takes material, whatever it is you got on, that it takes it in there, and they have to go in there and clean that out. And
or you can get infected pretty easy.
You get infected. That's what they have to watch for a few days, gunfire. It gets infected very fast.
And there was another thing that you said when telling that story, that call it the hand of God or whatever, but you said another German saw you, had a shot at you, and didn't take it.
Standing one hedgerow back behind us, already that far back, I didn't know they got behind us that far. And when I started through the gate, I mean, they just got openings to every hedgerow, like where a wagon or whatever can go through there. And when he pulled down on me, I thought, well, that's it. I was walking pretty close there, and I looked at him, and he looked at me, and he let me go.
Otherwise, we never would have heard that story from D-Day survivor E.T. Roberts. If you like, you can link to his complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com. When we come back, imagine flying an unarmed, powerless airplane into Normandy, landing it behind enemy lines, and getting out alive. For the man we'll hear from next, that was his reality on June 6, 1944. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.